more importantly, today's business. We have Dr. Richard Connolly, who's going to address us, and I'm going to allow him to introduce a bit more about his own background, because the person who was going to introduce him was a friend of Richard's, which is Andrew Mulligan. Sadly, Andrew's sick, so I'm standing in. But the issue of economics and of particularly energy security might not seem to be an obvious partner for the changing character of war. You know, there may not seem to be an obvious connection. But of course, anyone who studies strategy will know that there are multiple levers of national power, and that a better understanding of things other than simply the military instrument are vital if we're going to get some sense of where the world is going and how these strategic interactions will play out between Russia and Europe. And I think over lunch, I think you and I are probably moderately optimistic about the future. Possibly, you may qualify that at the moment. But it's today's talk is called Adapting to Sanctions, how Russia Responded to Western Economic Statecraft. Richard, thank you very much for being to speak. Looking forward very much to what you have to say.
Thank you, Rob. Cheers. Hello. So I am... Basically, this is going to be the first time that I'm going to deliver in condensed form a book that I've finished recently. It's currently going through the publication process, should be published in June or July. And the object of the book that I've written is to look at how sanctions that were imposed on Russia in 2014 affected Russia's not just economy, but its system of political economy. And that's what I'm going to talk about. So it's the first for me where I've tried to sum up what will amount to about 300 pages in, about 20, 25 minutes. So we'll see how I go. I also have to apologise in advance. So I'm going to make broad brush points. If, of course, there's anything which you think that sounds a bit odd or it needs to be qualified, then there's Q&A for that, and I'll try to make sure that I leave more time for Q&A, and that way I can respond to any questions of detail. I also have to apologise because I'm not the most gifted of PowerPoint writers, so we've got white black, background and black text, and there will be some charts, but I don't generally use PowerPoint in recent years. And I was writing this yesterday, I thought to myself, I'm going to need to practice this for any book launches and such like, because this really is rudimentary. I criticise students, I think, if they gave one of these to me at the university. So what I'm going to do, briefly in each instance, is firstly talk about sanctions and political economy, what the literature that's out there suggests we might expect to see in countries that are sanctioned. I identify what I think is a gap, and that gap is that very little of the sanctions literature focuses on how a target country, that's the term used when you're looking at sanctions, the target, how that target country will adapt and respond to sanctions. And I thought that was an interesting thing. That's really what the book's about. And my argument is that the system of political economy that the target country has plays a big role in mediating the impact of sanctions. The sanctions will affect some countries in different ways, depending on the type of system of political economy that they have. So I'll describe that very briefly. Even though I've written a whole chapter on it in the book, I'll have to keep it brief. Talk about the types of Western sanctions that were put in place, and what I'm most interested in, how Russia responded, how it adapted to the sanctions that were imposed in 2014. And I'll give examples then in the three sectors that were targeted by sanctions: energy, defence industry, and the financial sector. So this broadly follows the pattern of the structure of the book, but I'm going to try and just give you the key points. So we look at theory of sanctions. Why do countries impose sanctions, and how do they affect countries, target countries? First things first, when you read through the literature, is you need to distinguish between effectiveness on the one hand and impact, right? They're not the same thing. And very often, certainly when commentators, policy officials and such like speak about this, they often conflate these two terms. Effectiveness refers to whether or not the sender country, the countries that have put these sanctions in place, are their objectives being met, right? That's effectiveness. Whereas impact, to my mind, refers to the observable changes in the political economy of the target country. But impact doesn't always lead to effectiveness. You might have an impact on a country, cause all sorts of economic and political damage, but if that country doesn't do what you wanted it to do, your targets might not be met. And similarly, you can also say that effectiveness doesn't always require impact. It might be that in some cases sanctions can be successful despite the fact that there wasn't really much of an observable impact taking place. So I'll get that out of the way with that, because, as I say, this is something that I come across a lot when reading about sanctions. People do tend to conflate these two things. What are sanctions? A very famous book on the subject by David Baldwin. He essentially says they are economic instruments used by senders to help influence targets. That's quite broad. That can mean lots of different things. But essentially, it's based on the notion that there is a relationship, direct or indirect, between the economy of the target country and the political system of that country. And that you can moderate the political behaviour of the target by manipulating, shaping, influencing its economy. In very simple terms, we can just say economic pain, if you can cause it, should generate political gain. That is essentially what sanctions is. I'm simplifying, but essentially what it's all about. Or is it? Other people have said it's not just about influencing the target, right? There's a lot of literature out there. That's a primary goal, inducing a change in the behaviour of the target country. A country's invaded another country, so you impose sanctions to encourage them to withdraw from that country. Or a country perhaps is targeted by sanctions because other countries don't agree with its domestic political arrangements, the way it treats a particular ethnic group or such like. But that's what we could see as a primary goal. I think that's what most people understand sanctions are trying to achieve, but as pointed out some time ago, it's not always the case. There are secondary objectives, and these are focused on the domestic audience, making it look, for instance, to send a country's voters that you're doing something, right? That you're expressing the moral outrage of a country that for another country invading somewhere else, for instance. Or, quite simply, just to be shown that you're doing something. Right, that's a less ambitious goal than the primary goal. It doesn't really matter, in a sense, if you're focusing just on this, whether or not you induce a change in the target country. You just want to do it for domestic political purposes to generate satisfaction at home. There are also then tertiary objectives, and these are concerned with third countries, right? Not the target and not the center. Not the sender. Here, what we're looking at is for instance, if we take this example in 2014, that the US and European Union countries weren't just signaling to Russia they were dissatisfied with their behaviour, they were signaling to other countries. This is what happens if you annex another country, right? We will do something to uphold the international system as we see it. Some countries may disagree with that, but this is what we're going to do. So tertiary objectives are aimed not at the sender, not necessarily even at the target, but at other countries. It's about saying we're going to try and maintain a system here and perhaps deter other countries from engaging in objectionable behaviour further down the line. In practice, we tend to see countries pursuing all of these objectives simultaneously, or over time, that their emphasis on these objectives shifting and changing. Initially, they might think, or try and change, induce a change in the target country's behaviour, but after a while, it becomes more important that they show their domestic constituencies that they're doing something. This varies across time and cases. So I just really want to make the point, rather, that sender countries often pursue more than one. And this complicates efforts to analyse what sanctions do to target countries. Most of what sanctions, the sanctions literature, I wasn't familiar with the international relations literature on sanctions before Russia was had sanctions imposed on it in 2014. I'm primarily interested in the Russian economy. So then when I started reading all of the books and the articles that are out there that are concerned with sanctions, what I found was that most of them focus on whether and under what conditions sanctions work. They try to come up with sort of probabilistic statements. You know, 65% of the time, sanctions will help you achieve certain objectives. That's the first sort of strand of literature. Beyond that, it gets a little bit more complicated. People say, well, under what conditions does it tend to work? Do sanctions tend to work when countries are smaller, when they're larger, when they're democratic, or whether they're authoritarian? But the main strands of the sanctions literature are really concerned with whether it works. And that's because this literature has tended to emerge in line with policy, with the increasing use, especially since 1990, of sanctions as a often the primary instrument of statecraft when countries are seeking to influence others. So it's a rare strand of literature in a sense that's grown up and influenced more by policy than, let's say, the other way around. What I do in the book is focus on an area that I was surprised to find isn't really covered much, and that is how sanctions affect the target country. Instead of thinking, will it work, or what types of country will it work and will it not work in, I wanted to look at the process. How is it that sanctions, if you impose sanctions on a country, what do they do in response? Are they static? Do they just sit there and allow sanctions to exert their evil effect on the target country? Or do they respond and adjust and do something to mitigate or reduce the impact of sanctions? And that was what I've been sort of doing with myself for the last 3 or 4 years. As I say, most of the existing work tends to marginalise what I consider to be the analytically prior question. How do they affect countries? Surely you need to know that first before you're going to understand whether or not sanctions are likely to work. Much of the work, therefore, to me and to Clara Portella, has emerged in reverse order. So, this is where we are. I'm not going to go too much into the literature there, other than to say there's some gaps in it. Most of the literature doesn't look at the institutional environment of a domestic target country. They don't look at how the economy is organised. They don't look at how that economy is integrated with the wider global economy. And you think with sanctions, if you're going to impose a trade embargo or block access to capital, you are focusing on the key nodes that connect that country, the target country, with the global economy. Yet much of the literature doesn't really look at these relationships. Instead, as I said, they tend to focus on the percentage of cases where sanctions works or doesn't work. And that's because they look at it from the point of view of the senders. I try and look at it at the point of view of the target, right? So my book isn't about effectiveness. It isn't about whether or not I think sanctions have worked or not worked. I'll talk about that a little bit at the end because I do have views. I just didn't include them in the book. But for me, it's how do target countries adjust to reduce the economic pain so that they can then not give the sender countries political gain? And what I argue is it's the system of political economy that matters. Right, and that certain types of economy lend themselves to being more durable when placed under conditions of sanctions. Russia's not new to sanctions. During the Soviet period, for most of the Soviet period, the Soviet Union was under one form of sanctions or another from Western countries. So they have a long experience of dealing with this, of finding out ways of subverting sanctions and minimising their effects. So that's one thing. This is a country with a deep experience of being under sanctions. But for me, what was important was more this type of economy that Russia has. It's not the type of open market economy that we, as I have in the United Kingdom, the US, Germany. It's something different. And in my book, I spent a chapter talking about how I conceptualised the system of political economy. I didn't know what type of audience was going to be here today, whether you're an IR specialist or Russianist, or whether your interest was in the economy or politics. So I'll keep it reasonably simple. But what I do is argue that Russia, the Russian economy, is essentially a story of producing the majority of revenues in the country in the natural resources industry, specifically oil, to a lesser extent gas, and some other areas of natural resources. These revenues are then used and distributed by the state to other areas of the economy, revenue-dependent sectors. And this can include people who work for the civil service, people who depend on social welfare, the budgetniki, people who rely on federal budget spending for their income. But it might also include people who work in factories who rely on state demand for their jobs. People who work in the defence industry, for instance. 2 million people work in Russia's defence industry. And most of their orders come from the Russian government. And that Russian government gets its money largely from taxation of natural resources, production and exports. So the state in Russia performs a very important role. It distributes, it sits at the apex of this system, moving revenues and funds around the system from the places that make the money to the places that don't, but are politically and socially important, right? If you've got large, 2 million people working in the defence industry, it becomes important for various reasons to keep them in work. It means that you maintain a sovereign defence capability, which for a country like Russia is very important. But it also means that there are lots of cities across the country that have people with good, reasonably good incomes and jobs and such like. And that helps the local economies. So I describe this type of system. And I describe how the federal state in Russia, has quite a a strong, influential role within the Russian economy, right? Some people call it state capitalist, some people, incorrectly in my opinion, call it something approximating a planned economy. But it's fair to say the state does play an important role, right? It's dominant in these, what I would call sector A, in the natural resources industry, both directly and indirectly. It dominates the financial sector. So it's able to allow certain firms and certain people to have access to capital and others to not, right? It's in a very important position where it can divert and direct funds to those areas of the economy that it considers to be useful. And because the state is so dominant in some of these strategic areas, Lenin's commanding heights, because it's so dominant in these areas, it's able to use a variety of instruments, financial, institutional, changes to the law, diplomatic, making agreements with foreign countries that will benefit those areas that it considers to be important, that those people within the state consider to be important. So that's me very simply putting a point that it takes me a chapter to make in the book. Another important point is Russia's place in the global economy, right? In statistical terms, you'd say Russia looks like an open economy. Trade as a share of GDP is very high, higher than the US, higher than the United Kingdom, I think, as well, right? This is a very open, statistically speaking, economy. Sells a lot of oil and gas and buys a lot of stuff from other countries. However, the Russian state tends to be dominant in those sectors that link Russia with the wider global economy. So that gives it a unique ability to be able to alter the terms of its integration with the global economy, right? To exert control over that. In a way that would be much more difficult in a country like the United Kingdom. It's very difficult for the state to be able to tell BP or Shell what they need to be doing and what they shouldn't be doing. Russia, that's not such a problem, right? Rosneft and the people in the Kremlin have a very close relationship, so it's easier to make sure that their policies dovetail. So because of this unique role that the state plays in the economy, I argue it gives Russia greater potential durability under sanctions. And that really sort of ends up being the essence of my argument. And I explain how the Russian state was able to adapt and react to sanctions using these mechanisms that it had. And before I talk about that and get onto it, I was just going to quickly look at Western sanctions and the objectives that were outlined. And there were lots. There were primary, secondary, and tertiary. Right? I'm not going to list all of these here. Merely to say that if we look at public statements by Western leaders and Western officials over that period, they wanted to support Ukraine, affirm a credible commitment to the international order, but they also wanted to, and said repeatedly, inflict economic pain for political gain, to induce a change in the Russian government's foreign policy, and in particular towards Ukraine. They also wanted to deter it from acting in this way in other places in the future. So by imposing a cost on Russian actions, these Western policymakers were hoping that would make Russia think twice and before doing these things again. This, and I say anonymous here, and I have to keep it anonymous, but it's the most senior official that I met from the most powerful country of the sender countries, who said that the objective was even grander than that. It was regime change, right? By causing so much pain on the Russian elites that they would basically choose to overthrow the president and replace him with somebody more amenable. And whether or not that was reflective of a wider feeling within the country in question, I'm not so sure. But this was certainly somebody who I thought was well placed to make such a comment. And I was surprised when I heard that the ambitions were that grand. Lots of objectives. We'll come back later to whether or not any of those were achieved. But what I'm interested in is the response, right? What did the Russian government do when put under sanctions? And I argue in each of the chapters, in each of the sectors that I look at, that it took the form of three main types of policy. First one, securitization, right, of economic policy in sectors that previously might not have been considered to have been areas that those with an interest in security would have been concerned about. And even where that was the case, let's say the defense industry, it became more intense, this securitization. And securitization justified the Russian government undertaking policies that meant that the state's role grew in those sectors to a greater level than it was, let's say, pre-2014. So securitization, by casting the security threat, by looking at the threat that sanctions had for the Russian economy justified the state intervening within the Russian economy to make it more independent, to make it more sovereign, and to basically make it more secure. But that justifies taking unusual actions that weren't usually justified. So what's the first thing that we see? We see that in general, and we see it in the different sectors. I'll go into that. What else? Secondly, we see Russification of domestic economic capabilities. Basically building things and providing services that previously Western countries were providing. They said, well, okay, if they can prevent us from accessing these things, then we need to make sure we can supply at least some of them ourselves. So we see this. We see an import substitution campaign which they speak about even before Russia annexed Crimea in February 2014. It's as though they knew what was coming. They started to develop legislation to promote the production of domestic goods and to limit imports in these strategically important areas. Energy, defence and finance. These are the areas that Western countries impose sanctions in, but they also pick some other areas, pharmaceuticals and agriculture. The third main strand of the Russian response was an intensification of state efforts to promote what I call, and it's a horrible, ugly word, but I'm going to use it anyway, a more pluridirectional foreign economic policy, right? To trade and have capital, greater capital flows with a wider range of countries, okay? I tried to avoid those horrible sort of academic words, but I did slip into that one, pluridirectional. But what we see after 2014 is more intense efforts to cultivate closer ties. Most people focus on China, maybe Asia a bit more widely, but it was broader than that, with Middle Eastern countries, with Latin American countries. We see Russian officials and Russian and heads of Russian state-owned firms flying around the world, trying to have closer relations with these other countries, and in particular, to replace Western sources of capital and technology, and as markets for their goods. So that's the broad response. How long have I got, Rob? About 5-10 minutes?
I wasn't paying attention.
I think we started at 10 past, didn't we? So I thought half an hour of talking and then you can ask questions.
Or okay. 40 if you want. I mean, you've got plenty of time.
I don't like to bore people. People are always more excited when they're speaking. Okay. So the three sectors, very briefly. Energy was the first one, right? Before 2014, the energy sector in Russia had become a much more outward-looking, modern, cooperative sector of the Russian economy. Lots of joint ventures had been formed with Western majors, Statoil, Exxon, BP, partnership Shell, for exploration and production in the Arctic, offshore, and on Russia's tight oil formations, right? Russia has the largest tight oil formations in the world, potentially. They just don't exploit them very much at the moment. And Russia, prior to 2014, had seen a very important role for the West in helping exploit these areas, bringing Western know-how, technology, and capital to bear. And it was precisely these areas that sanctions targeted. Sanctions basically said you couldn't transfer technology for the exploitation of these areas that the Russians saw as their sort of new frontier of energy production that would replace their existing energy areas of energy production. Currently, most Russian oil extraction and gas extraction takes place in Western Siberia. In the future, it's likely that it'll either take place in different types of formation in Western Siberia, or it'll take place offshore. Right? And sanctions are targeted preventing all of those types of extraction. However, as we'll see, and this ends up being very, very important, there wasn't complete unity. The US said these sanctions apply to all projects underway straight away. The EU said any projects that are already underway don't have to stop. All right? It's the grandfathering clause. As we'll see, that has a big impact on how energy sanctions played out in Russia. Elsewhere, there were some other interesting exceptions. Japan chose not to impose sanctions on the energy industry. The Japanese government did on defence. They didn't buy any Russian weapons, nor did they sell them any. So that was a very easy thing to do. They did in finance as well, but not in energy, because the Japanese are a very energy-deficient country and have always had a long-standing interest in being involved in Russia's energy deposits. So they chose not to impose sanctions on that area. And given Japan's role as a producer of technology in the world, that was significant. And the various legal loopholes existed as well, which were exploited later. I can go into those in Q&A. But all those three things that I spoke about, Securitisation, Russification and diversification all take place within the energy industry. The state uses its position at the apex of the system of political economy to use state public funds, national wealth fund from the central bank funds, to provide liquidity, to provide money and capital to firms that were targeted by sanctions. This was especially important at the end of 2014 when Russia's largest energy company, Rosneft, was suffering from a lack of access to capital. The government was able to use public resources to help it, to moderate the impact of sanctions. There was an import substitution campaign, quite an extensive one in the energy industry, building new ships that would enable the exploitation of offshore deposits, new oil rigs, about Russifying the oil field services industry, right? Making sure that those types of services were provided by Russian firms, not by foreigners, right? So foreigners couldn't cut off the supply of these services in the future. Money was given and incentives were put in place to promote the production of domestic equipment, right? Instead of buying these sources of technology from abroad, trying to produce some within Russia. On top of that, there were also efforts at diversifying Russia's energy ties with other countries. Since 2014, Rosneft has signed deals with Indian companies, Chinese companies in particular, but also Saudis, the Saudi government, and other countries across the world in an effort to both expand its own markets, but also to acquire new sources of technology. These firms have also engaged in joint ventures and have had projects that have been co-financed by Chinese and Indian backers rather than Western ones. So all those three sort of broad areas of response that I've described took place in the energy industry, and I'll quickly look at some of the data that shows how they tried to do that. Here are the targets of specific types of oil equipment that they wanted to produce themselves. They said, look, we're reliant on imports for, you know, a large proportion of all of these high-tech areas. And so they set them targets, they set Russian industry targets and provided money to replace some of these items. That's a process that's still underway. Some of these are making some progress, some of them are a bit slower. But that, you know, they were a very clear, sophisticated, determined plan as to what they wanted to do. But they also acquired equipment from different countries. So instead of just thinking, well, we'll try and produce it ourselves, they recognise that this is going to be something that's quite difficult. So then they started to acquire oil and gas equipment from other countries. This is my black and white that CUP asked me to make sure my figures were in. It's not very good, I think, from a distance. But what this basically says is that after 2014, the EU's role as a supplier of oil and gas equipment declined and Asia's increased, right? No surprise there. They started to source supplies of oil and gas equipment from other countries. Now, some of that equipment could well have been Western equipment that's simply been rerouted through through China. I also, and I spent more evidence for that, the biggest increase was in former Soviet countries. Kazakhstan and Belarus suddenly started exporting lots of oil and gas equipment that they didn't before, along with mussels and prawns and things like this. So we know that we can, I think, you know, strongly suspect that there's evidence there of trade diversion taking place. But it supports my point, this evidence, that they diversified their sources of supply. It wasn't coming directly, at least, from Western countries, and they made efforts to build their own. In terms of the impact on oil and gas production, it wasn't intended to be in the short term. It was supposed to take place over the long run. But nevertheless, for the Russian government, they could point to the fact that production and exports grew throughout the entire period when Russia was under sanctions. Until the end of 2016, when they took part in this agreement with OPEC to limit production, only then did output start to decline a little bit. But that was something that the Russian government chose to do to try to support prices. What we also see is that investment in the oil and gas industry after 2014 grew faster than it did elsewhere in the economy, which, all things being equal, means that probably the share of oil and gas and energy in the Russian economy will get bigger, not smaller. Because they're investing in future production. So it's not as though the companies were looking at sanctions thinking, oh my God, this is dreadful, how are we ever going to make a buck? They invested more, not less. And here's the very interesting one. Joint ventures that took place between Western, that were agreed between Western energy companies and Russian oil companies before 2014, the ones that involved American firms were stalled. All the ones that involved European firms have carried on, because of this grandfathering clause. New deals have been signed because of legal loopholes. Some companies, for example, have said, well, sanctions target shale oil, so we'll just redesignate shale oil as a limestone deposit, right? And so then we can still do business here. So European firms have tended not to implement, at least in the energy industry, sanctions in the way that US firms have been forced to. In the US, OFAC, the Treasury organisation put in charge of enforcing sanctions, have been much firmer than European Union have. So that's defence. Right. Again, sorry, that was energy. My point being, the Russian government used its position, its control over these oil companies and gas companies, its ability to divert financial flows from the public purse into these organisations. It used all these instruments that were at its disposal to moderate the impact of sanctions. One that I didn't speak about then, and I should have done, was of course the gas deal that was signed with China. A month or two after Crimea was annexed, right? They've been negotiating this deal for a long time and couldn't come to an agreement. But within 2 months, they decided that they thought it was politically expedient to sign this deal. And that's very important. That gas pipeline is being built. Over 1,000 kilometres of Sila Siberia have been built. It looks as though it should start delivering gas, roughly on schedule. Despite the claims of some who think that it's never going to happen. It looks as though it will be happening, expensive as it is. The Chinese government also stepped in with extra funding for the Yamal liquefied natural gas plants in the Arctic Circle. And that, as you may have seen in the news, recently delivered gas to the US via the United Kingdom. And this was a project that was... its owners were targeted under sanctions, and the technology used there was targeted under sanctions. Chinese stepped in with the capital to make this project go ahead. Defence industry before 2014 was not like the energy industry. It wasn't as, it didn't have as close links, certainly not joint ventures with Western countries. However, some changes had taken place under the, at the time, Defence Minister Serzhukov. The Russians had agreed to buy some weapon systems from Western European countries, some armoured vehicles, some ships. But what they did was rely on Europe, in particular, European countries, for components used in the production of weapon systems. Not final weapon systems themselves, but components that are used in the production of them, particularly electronic components. And Russia also relied a lot on supplies for particular items from Ukraine, ship engines, helicopter engines, that were used to produce final weapon systems. And sanctions, both imposed by the West and also by Ukraine in response to the fact that it had had a slice of its country taken off it, prevented the sale of most of these weapon systems. Some still happen. The Italians continued to sell armoured vehicles to the under this grandfathering clause again. The French backed down under pressure. They could have sold the Mistral ships in principle. Sanctions didn't prevent them, but they made the decision that for political reasons it'd be a good idea to sell it to somebody else, the Egyptians in the end. But sanctions saw the sale of particular dual use items and some weapon systems fall after 2014. And so, what did the Russians do? Again, securitisation, although this was always an industry that had been securitised. But here, the focus was especially on import substitution, in particular in replacing the items that were previously supplied by Ukraine. So Russia undertook a sort of a crash import substitution programme, building brand new factories to build helicopters and ship engines that they hadn't been producing, that they'd never produced before. These leaks went back to the Soviet period. Some of these factories are already underway, providing helicopter engines, for instance. Some of them are about to come online and provide ship engines, for instance. So import substitution was very important. They also diversified their supplies of electronic components. I'll show you an example of that in a moment. And it was bolstered by, at the time, Russia was already in the midst of a rearmament program. So they were able to use a large volume of public funding to support precisely those enterprises that had been targeted by sanctions. So that was helpful to have big increase, expansion of domestic demand. And again, the Russian government used banks, state-owned banks, to channel capital to these enterprises that might have been suffering under sanctions. And so I argue in this chapter that it did cause some disruption, particularly Ukrainian ship engines. That meant that Russia's plans to acquire several frigates as part of its rearmament program had to be put off, right? Those frigates either weren't delivered or will be delivered at some point in the future. So there was certainly some disruption, but it wasn't decisive. They continued to rearm and procure more weapons than they had done in the entire post-Soviet period. Couple of examples, diversification. Here again, these colours aren't very helpful. But what we see here is that the sales of electronic components by EU countries collapses after 2014 as a share of total, I say collapse, it's perhaps a bit harsh, it declines significantly. And is replaced by Asian countries. I'll give you one example. In 2013, the year before sanctions were put in place, the number one supplier of electronic components to Russia was China. That was still the case in 2017. But number two, three, four, and five were all EU countries. 2016, none of those EU countries are in the top five anymore. Number two is a country that in 2013 had occupied 31st place. Indonesia is now Russia's second largest source of electronic components that would be used in sort of dual use. Capabilities for use in weapons production. Whether they're Dutch electronic components that are going around the world and finding their way to Russia, I'm not sure. But certainly Indonesia has suddenly become a very important player on Russia's electronic components market. And this here just illustrates the extent to which defence procurement spending rose. This is adjusted for inflation here as well, so I've deflated this in ruble terms. We can see after sanctions, it wasn't, I think, in response to sanctions, but it certainly helped moderate the impact of sanctions as defence spending grew. If we look at the impact on output, they basically continued to re-equip their armed forces at post-Soviet record rates. Right? Some items, it was slow, in the Navy in particular, because ship engines were affected by breakdown of relations with Ukraine, but also Germany. But Russia continued, this is in ruble terms, arms exports. Under sanctions, in ruble terms, they grew, partially because the ruble depreciated vis-a-vis the dollar, but also because Russia continues to be the second largest exporter of weapons in the world, and is signing lots of deals. It wasn't materially affected by sanctions being put in place. So, final sector. So we can see, so far, energy and defence. The Russian government was able to use the resources at its disposal to forge new relationships with foreign countries, to bolster domestic capabilities, and to increase the control of the state in those sectors. These things happened in the financial sector as well. Russia's always been, in the post-Soviet period, extremely dependent on foreign capital flows. The domestic financial system is quite small. It's got a small domestic deposits base, not enough savings, not a great big pension fund market or anything like that. So whenever Russia's gone through a period where it is investing a lot, very often it's foreign capital that supplies foreign banks that supply the capital. And this tends to be correlated with oil production and price. When oil prices are high, capital flows into Russia. When it goes down, it flees. Sanctions targeted precisely this vulnerability to foreign capital. They said that certain banks and certain firms outside the financial industry would not be able to access capital, or at least long-term capital. So this was, showed an awareness amongst Western policymakers that this was an Achilles heel, as it were, and they were hoping to induce a sudden stop, or indeed a reversal of capital flows from going into Russia to make them come out. And of course, the Russians responded with the same three-pronged response. Securitization. The financial sector had never previously, as I understood it, been mentioned in things like the National Security Document and such like, but after 2014 it is. The Russian government then becomes very interested in the rapid construction of a national payment system, so that if Russia were excluded from the international electronic payment systems like SWIFT, that they would have their own, that they wouldn't have to resort to using fax machines. They started to show an increased awareness of the importance of reducing debt, particularly amongst state-owned companies, debt owed to Western countries in particular. And there was an emphasis on financial sovereignty, bringing Russian money back, repatriation, de-offshoreization is the word they use. I didn't back that up. About bringing capital held elsewhere, bringing it back home, under the guise of helping Russia become a more secure and less vulnerable economy. Russification, so promoting the use of domestic capital, domestic resources, using the central bank to lend to strategically important firms, so that they wouldn't have to go to the West or to Western banks or come up with new ways. of accessing capital. Informal capital controls were imposed in 2014 and 15. Basically, the heads of Russia's largest companies were gathered into a room and told, bring your money back home and let us have your dollars, in very simple terms, right? You need to help us at the moment. You're all very rich, and we allow you to become very rich, but right now, we need your foreign currency. So bring it home, if you could. Be so kind. As I said, there was a capital amnesty, didn't really work at the time, and they're having a second bite of that particular cherry at the moment. There was also an effort at making the banking system sanitised, about making it work better. That's not a direct response to sanctions, but it was something that was seen as helping and promoting the financial health of the country. So along with Russification and securitisation, we see diversification. Now Russian firms and the Russian government signed deals with the Chinese government, with the leaders of the BRICS countries, about creating new sources of capital, new development banks in which Russia was a shareholder, but which Russian firms could access as well, and which they have accessed since 2014. So even in the financial sector, and that's just official, if we then look at what companies have done, we see lots of Russian firms have been more active in trying to float bonds on Asian markets and Middle Eastern markets. The Saudis, for instance, invested in the Russian Direct Investment Fund after 2014. I think that was $5 billion and have signaled interest in investing more. We saw the privatisation, or the so-called privatisation, of parts of Rosneft in 2015 and 16. Initially that involved the Qatari government, then later the Chinese, or a bank with links to the Chinese government. So we see in the financial sector exactly the same elements of response as we see in the defence and the energy industry. And did this work? Well, here, if we look at capital flows, this is money coming in and going out of the country. We look at the 2008-09 crisis, we can see it was very sharp fluctuations in capital flows then. And if we go back to 2013 and if we look, this is when sanctions are imposed, right? We can see that's not as severe as what happened a year before. This is when Rosneft signed a deal with BP and when there was a financial crisis in Cyprus. That exerted, those two things, a much stronger effect on Russia, on capital flows into Russia than sanctions did. That's here. And we can see the size of these fluctuations declines over time. This is the impact of imposing informal capital controls and of sourcing out, of exerting greater control over the financial system to stop people from sending their money abroad. What else happens? The risk, the perception of risk went down. This is at the end of 2014. Sanctions were imposed here. We can see the perception of risk grew. That wasn't just because of sanctions. That was largely because the price of oil had gone down and Russia's economic prospects with it. But as we can see, since then, after these measures were put in place and as oil prices recovered, the perception of risk is now, and it's gone down since I wrote this book last summer, they're now at much lower than pre-crisis levels. Okay, so financial sanctions had, I think, some impact early on, at the end of 2014, but that impact has subsided dramatically since. You would think that if you had a country that was placed under financial sanctions, that they would have difficulty financing investment in the country. And sure enough, we saw that investment declined during this period when Russia was under sanctions. However, several points for the observer, it was already in decline before sanctions. That was to do with the domestic sources of an economic slowdown. And it has recovered modestly since. And what a lot of survey data show is that Russian firms' demand for capital has been quite high, but they've not been able to find it. So for some firms, they've wanted capital but can't access it. But the difference, and again, going back to the system of political economy in Russia, the firms that can get it are the politically well-connected ones, the large ones in sectors A and B that are socially and politically important. The ones that can't will be those small, medium-sized enterprises in non-strategic industries, probably the ones that people in the West would think are where the modernisers reside. They're the ones who don't access capital and have greater difficulty getting hold of it. The larger firms that are strategically important have still enjoyed access to capital. Final slide, bet you're relieved. Well, final picture. Finance, the impact on foreign direct investment. These are gross inflows here in orange. What we see here, this is when sanctions were imposed. If I updated this, which I should have done, I know the data actually for the gross inflows in 2017, some of them are up here. Right, so what does that suggest? It suggests that gross inflows of foreign direct in Russia largely being unaffected by sanctions. A large proportion of that is Russian investment coming via Cyprus and the British Virgin Islands and such like. But it also includes foreign investment. And it hasn't exhibited a particularly different pattern than pre-sanctions. What has been a change is in net foreign direct investment and what Russian owners of foreign assets abroad do. But in terms of inflows entering Russia, not much difference at all. So, conclusion to sum up, three main points that I make in the book. What was the impact over that three-year period? Basically, sanctions caused some initial disruption, but the impacts on targeted sectors declined because of the Russian strategic response, because the state was able to use its position and exploit the type of economy that's been built in the last 25 years to do that. What was the strategic response and how did it work? As I've been arguing, they were able to use a range of tools and resources, many of which were readily available due to the specific characteristics of Russia's system of political economy. Countries like the United Kingdom or the US would have to undergo extremely special changes in legislation to make these sorts of things possible. But for Russia, it was easy. When you own most of the strategically important sectors anyway, you can make these things happen and you can channel resources to them. And that enabled them to cushion these targeted sectors from the worst effects of sanctions. Final point that I make, or question that I answer, did sanctions reshape the structure of Russia's domestic political economy and its relationship with the global economy? I argue, yes, it did, or at least started the process. 3 years isn't a long time in the grand scheme of a country's integration with the global economy. But what we have seen in the last 3.5 years is Russia making greater efforts at trading with other parts of the world. Their share of Russia's trade has grown. Their share of capital flows has grown. And Russia's state involvement in strategic sectors has increased. Right? All of those things have happened. And I think a large proportion of why that happened is due to the response to sanctions. I also think that this has made Russia a less vulnerable, more economically secure economy. That's not necessarily good for its economic development. For those who want market reform and for want those types of policies to be implemented, this doesn't necessarily help. So I'm not suggesting that this is going to generate 10% annual GDP growth, right? But what I am saying is that as far as the political economy is concerned, I think it's reduced Russia's vulnerability to sanctions considerably and increased state control. I said I'd briefly mention effectiveness. If we're thinking about were these sanctions effective from the sender country's point of view, I personally don't think primary objectives have been achieved. Some people say, well, they could have invaded Odessa or Kiev. I think that sort of requires you to think that's what they were planning on doing in the first place. I have my suspicions that that wasn't the case. But we'll never know whether or not it deterred Russia from any more sort of grander ambitions. But certainly as far as returning Crimea and not being militarily involved in the Donbass is concerned, we failed on both of those measures. However, secondary objectives. Have we shown our domestic electorates that we're doing something? I think we've done that, and that's very important. We can't underestimate that, the importance of that for most people who aren't that concerned with foreign policy and will just think we're doing something and the right thing. Final one, tertiary objectives. What does these signals send to the international community? What I argue in the book is that actually what we might have done is ended up sending the wrong signals to the international community. These sanctions, I don't think, have inflicted much in the way of economic pain. They haven't caused much in the way of political gain. And if anything, have made us look a little bit weak. I think this grandfathering clause that the EU had in place meant that there was already, even when they looked like they were unified, that there was transatlantic unity, there wasn't really. I think that's going to get even worse. And so that hasn't really shown a great deal of credibility to third countries. And I also think that if you look at the way in which Russia's been able to respond and can point to the fact that it hasn't, as some people said it was in 2015, on the verge of collapse or collapsed or anything like that, that actually it's managed to do reasonably well, that doesn't present such a bad example to other countries that might be find themselves in a similar position in the future. And Russia showed how you go about doing it. And then I was going to finish with some implications for the new sanctions. Maybe we'll leave that for Q&A because I need to have a drink of water and I'm sure you've heard my voice enough. Thank you.